You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere.
Welcome, everybody, and happy Monday afternoon to each and every one of you. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. Really excited this afternoon. At the bottom of this hour, I'll be joined by current alderperson Jocasta Zamarripa. She has just announced late last week that she will be running for Secretary of State, a position that will be left unoccupied since Sarah Godelewski is now running for Lieutenant Governor. She is the Democrat that currently holds that role. And of course, the Secretary of State jobs used to be sleepy little affairs that basically not a lot of people paid attention to. But in the age of election denialism, since Trump started peddling the big lie in 2020, those jobs have much more attention than they ever did. So we'll be talking with the alderwoman at the bottom of this half hour. But to start off this Monday afternoon, we've got some news to cover. Over the weekend, let's begin internationally. Russia launched its largest air attack of the war to date on Ukraine overnight from this past Saturday into Sunday morning. They set the main government building on fire in central Kyiv and killed at least four people, according to Ukrainian officials on Sunday. Those deaths included one infant. President Volodymyr Zelensky said that the drone and missile barrage, again, causing damage across the north, south, and east of the country, including cities like Zaporizhia, Kryvyi Rih, and Odessa, as well as the Sumy and Chernihiv regions. He said this, quote, "Such killings now, when real diplomacy could have already begun long ago, are a deliberate crime and prolongation of the war," end quote. Again, just a reminder, President Trump said that he would have that conflict resolved in a day or two after taking office. Doesn't seem like that's working at all. Also recall, of course, Donald Trump literally rolled out the red carpet in Alaska just a few weeks ago for President Putin. Didn't quite do the same for President Zelensky, so watch this space, more to come. In other international news, the U.S. State Department has imposed sanctions on three Palestinian human rights aid groups that had previously asked the International Criminal Court to investigate and arrest Israeli leaders over accusations of war crimes in Gaza. You'll recall that late last year in November, the ICC issued arrest warrants for Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, former defense minister Yoav Gallant, and a now deceased Hamas official. Secretary of State Marco Rubio said on Thursday that the U.S. will sanction three NGOs, in particular Al-Haq Al-Mezan Center for Human Rights and the Palestinian Center for Human Rights, for engaging in what he called the ICC's illegitimate targeting of Israel. At some point in time on this program, we'll do a long dive into the history of the International Criminal Court, a court whose jurisdiction the United States refuses to this day to acknowledge, despite the fact that the U.S. really led the groundwork internationally for what eventually led into the International Criminal Court, specifically related to prosecutions of war crimes in the former Yugoslavia and other conflicts coming out of the 90s. So that'll be worthy of a deeper dive when we've got some more time. But again, watch this space. Pretty extraordinary. And on Monday, turning now nationally, the Supreme Court has lifted a federal judge's order prohibiting government agents from making indiscriminate immigration-related stops in the LA area that challengers called blatant racial profiling. The court's brief unsigned order gave no reasons. And it will not be the last word in the case, as this is coming up again from the shadow docket. The case is pending on its substance in a federal appeals court and again may reach the Supreme Court. The court's three liberal justices dissented, saying this is by Justice Sonia Sotomayor, quote, "We should not have to live in a country where the government can seize anyone who looks Latino, speaks Spanish, and appears to work a low-wage job. Rather than stand idly by while our constitutional freedoms are lost, I dissent." Justice Sotomayor was joined by Justices Kagan and Jackson. The majority's failure to explain the ruling is leaving some doubt, even amongst legal scholars, as to whether or not the reasoning applies nationwide or is only limited to Los Angeles, where the administration has said that the problems flowing from illegal immigration are especially pronounced. Mayor Karen Bass, in response, mayor of Los Angeles, said she expected the ruling to have sweeping consequences. Quote, I want the entire nation to hear me when I say this isn't just an attack on the people of LA. This is an attack on every person in every city in this country. And in that same vein, as it relates to Chicago, over the weekend, the White House posted what appeared to be an AI-generated meme riffing on some imagery and the name of the movie Apocalypse Now, with Donald Trump sort of superimposed into Robert Duvall's character, calling it, Chicago Bible. It was messed up. Basically, it used the imagery of Apocalypse Now. Again, Donald Trump as the Robert Duvall character promising Chicago Populous. I don't know what the word was. It was a made-up word. And saying in the text of the post, Chicago is about to find out why they call it the War Department. Now, this is much of Donald Trump's typical trolling. But really? You're declaring war on an American city? And you're taking the role of the wackadoodle Robert Duvall character in Apocalypse Now? Yikes. At minimum, cringy. Huh. Over the weekend, the surge that Donald Trump had been promising in Chicago has yet to materially take place, at least according to local and state officials. Just a handful of arrests there on Sunday by federal agents, an advocacy group reported Monday. This takes us to Washington, D.C., where Donald Trump, in a bizarre series of comments at the Museum of the Bible in Washington, D.C., claimed that there is zero crime in Washington, D.C., and that made some reference to the fact that men beating up their wives really isn't crime. It was weird. Take a listen, everybody. Cut 12.
There's no crime. They said crime's down 87%. I said, no. It's more than 87%. Virtually nothing. And much lesser things that take place in the home they call crime. You know, they'll do anything they can to find something. If a man has a little fight with the wife, they say this was a crime, see? So now I can't claim 100%.
I'm sorry. What? I don't know. I think millions of battered women who've gotten their butts kicked by their husband would consider being beaten, you know, a physical assault to be very much a crime, no matter where it might occur. And just so you know, on Sunday alone, there was a homicide, 6 motor vehicle thefts, 2 assaults with a deadly weapon, 4 robberies, and more than 30 other thefts, according to Washington, D.C. Metro Police Department statistics. Not a non-zero amount of crime. And let's turn to another one of our fair president's other lies. Do you remember when it came out that there was news that Donald Trump had written a poem for Jeffrey Epstein's birthday as part of this enormous bound birthday book, and that he drew kind of a dirty picture, signed it, his signature was kind of in the approximate pubic regions of the sketch, and he denied it. He said, I don't do drawings. I have no idea how to do it. I don't do any of that. And then promised and then sued Rupert Murdoch because the New York Post and the Wall Street Journal reported this. Remember that? In case you didn't, we have some of the audio of Donald Trump denying that he does drawings. Take a listen.
Yeah. Do you think that drawing, I think I heard you say something the other day, that the drawing that was the subject of the Wall Street Journal report.
I don't do drawings. I'm not a drawing person. I don't do drawings. Sometimes people say, would you draw a building and I'll draw 4 lines and a little roof, you know, for a charity stuff. But I'm not a drawing person. I don't do drawings of women, that I can tell you. They say there's a drawing of a woman, and I don't do drawings of women.
I don't do drawings of women. I don't do drawings, maybe a little building sketch. Well, ooh, it's a little uncomfortable that now members of Congress have seen the drawing and the birthday wishes, which I'll read to you in just a moment. Yeah, like the actual document, the original, unredacted. They've seen the birthday book. And if that little audio clip of Donald Trump wasn't enough to trigger recollection, here were his words on July 17th in a Truth Social post. Quote, "The Wall Street Journal printed a fake letter supposedly to Epstein. These are not my words, not the way I talk. Also, I don't draw pictures. I told Rupert Murdoch it was a scam, that he shouldn't print the fake story, but he did, and now I'm going to sue his ass off and that of his third-rate newspaper. Thank you for your attention to this matter." Yes, indeed. Thank you for your attention to this matter. The president lies about crime in Washington, D.C., and he lies about something that it is so easy to prove he was lying about. Republicans and Democrats in the House of Representatives have now seen the actual original letter and drawing. This was all part of a subpoena to the Epstein estate, which holds the birthday book in which Donald Trump's drawing and body poem slash letter to Epstein exists. Again, the estate was the one responding to the correspondence, to the subpoena from the House Oversight Committee, not the DOJ. And it was the estate that has now provided the House Oversight Committee, Republicans and Democrats included, access to not just the birthday book, but other documents. Aides for the Oversight Committee said today that the documents included this redacted version of the so-called birthday book, as well as numerous other documents, including Epstein's will and a non-prosecution agreement between Epstein and the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of Florida, as well as thousands of pages of financial records. This is going to be a little hard for the president to explain. So you told the American public that you never wrote such a thing, that it's all a hoax. You then sued Rupert Murdoch and the Wall Street Journal. But now everyone's seen that you're the emperor with no clothes on and that you're the big fat liar. I'm going to give you the exact language of that birthday love letter, that expression of shared secrets, and the body drawing itself when we come back on the other side, as today's breaking news and the news of the weekend are brought to you right here on the Civic Media Radio Network. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show. News continues on the other side. Don't go anywhere. We will have you fully up to speed in just a few more minutes. So stay put.
You're listening to Civic Media. Stay up to date on the latest news and information for your local community and Wisconsin by signing up for our free email newsletter. Visit civicmedia.us/email to get started.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. Some of the weekend and day's news this first half hour. In a few minutes, we're going to be joined by City of Milwaukee Alderwoman Jocasta Zamarripa. She's just announced her race to become Secretary of State in 2026. We'll talk to her all about it in just a few. Right now, still reviewing the weekend's news. Mondays are always a little intense because, whew, a lot seems to happen between Friday news dumps and the Sunday morning talk shows. Today, we're talking about the House Oversight Committee's subpoena of the Jeffrey Epstein estate. And the estate's response, they're providing documents on a rolling basis. The first set of documents, which include the notorious Jeffrey Epstein birthday book, which contains letters from all sorts of names that you may recognize, including our President Donald Trump's name, and includes a poem or letter, I don't know. It's creepy. I'm going to read it to you. A poem for Jeffrey Epstein on his birthday that is written in betwixt a Sharpie sketch of a woman's sort of hourglass silhouette type shape. Here's what it says. And again, this is information, the image posted by members of the House Oversight Committee today. Voiceover. "There must be more to life than having everything. Donald. Yes, there is, but I won't tell you what it is. Jeffrey, nor will I, since I know what it is. Donald, we have certain things in common, Jeffrey. Jeffrey? Yes, we do, come to think of it. Donald. This part's a little hard to read. Enigmas never age. Have you noticed that? Jeffrey, as a matter of fact, it was clear to me the last time I saw you. Donald, a pal is a wonderful thing. Happy birthday, and may every day be another wonderful secret. Donald J. Trump, with the name Donald scribbled sort of in the rough pubic area of where the sketch would be. If that is not the creepiest thing, do we actually need to see video footage of the completely unmentionable things? Why do you think he denied it? Potentially because it is this creepy, and if this was sent by Donald Trump, written by Donald Trump for Jeffrey Epstein, pray tell, what enigma? What is the more to life than having everything, these secrets that apparently they both share and know about that no one else does? If this is not problematic for even the most diehard Trump supporter, what would be? He's talking to a convicted child sex trafficker and saying, there must be more to life than having everything. And talking about how they have things in common, this more to life than having everything. This is something that we have in common. We're enigmas and we never age. A pal is a wonderful thing, and may every day be another wonderful secret. 855-752-4842, 855-75-CIVIC. This is behavior that is simply unacceptable from a sitting president of the United States. Charles from Milwaukee, your thoughts on the day's news. Pretty shocking stuff here.
Yes, it is. And you know, Maggie, it's funny because he says, I don't talk like this. Well, we heard him on the bus with Billy Bush about what women allow the rich and famous to do. And he gets so excited, he just starts kissing them without even asking them. And if you follow him, or if you don't follow him, for any of those conservatives out there that's listening, do a little fact checking. This is the same guy that talked about how he wants to sleep with his daughter, talks about her body. I have two daughters. I couldn't imagine saying, oh, look at my daughter's body. I think if she wasn't my daughter, I think I can have a piece of that. Who says that?
And like, all of that has been out for so long. What I think is really shocking here is the innuendo in this little note and the fact that it's to Jeffrey Epstein. It's one thing to look at the hundreds and hundreds of pictures of these guys together that includes the time period in which he was apparently engaged in the sex trafficking. It's another to read something in Donald Trump's hand with his signature on it that alludes to these wonderful secrets and being an enigma. And there's more to life than having everything. Well, when you have bought absolutely every material object that could ever be purchased, what truly is left to consume? And it seems to me those things are potentially, for a man like Jeffrey Epstein, very clearly the thing that is most verboten in any society, and that is the sexual exploitation of children. And it seems like our president was sort of wink, wink, nudge, nudging him, like, that's cool. Go right ahead. How does he explain this? And the fact that he's got this lawsuit pending against Rupert Murdoch, Charles, it's just disgusting. Well, thanks so much. Go ahead, Charles. Go ahead.
That won't go anywhere because if he has to sit to be questioned about that, he's never going to sit. So that'll never happen. Hopefully Rupert Murdoch will stand strong and not give in. I don't think he will. He won't give in to Trump, but Trump will never sit down and be deposed of that. That's
the point, Charles, right? Like all this bluster about like I filed a lawsuit, that is just smokescreen, because Donald Trump, if he presses these lawsuits, he will eventually end up in a deposition chair. And it would be highly relevant to ask him all kinds of questions about exactly what he did that was such a wonderful secret. Every day, another wonderful secret shared between Donald Trump and Jeffrey Epstein. My inquiring mind wants to know. We're going to come back on the other side with City of Milwaukee Alderwoman Jocasta Zamarripa. She's running for Secretary of State. Stay tuned. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. One of the great things about this job is that from time to time, someone that I've known for a long time and been witness to their career and seen them really live in a space of public service, sometimes as community leaders, like our good friend Angela Lang, who frequently joins me as a guest here on this program, but also my next guest, who's been on the show a few times, but is now stepping up in a capacity as a candidate in a new way for a statewide office. She's served in the state legislature, and now she is one of the alderpersons and alderwoman for the City of Milwaukee. She's been a tireless advocate for the LGBTQIA plus community, and I'm so pleased to have with me this afternoon newly announced candidate for Secretary of State, Jocasta Zamarripa. Thank you so much, Jocasta, for being here with us.
Thank you, Dawn, for having me. Maggie Dawn, for having me. This is an exciting opportunity, and I can't wait to talk to you about it today.
I know. It's amazing. This is going to be, I think, a really thrilling time for all of us. And one of the interesting things about our friendship going back a number of years is I have only ever had one name for you, and it's Maggie Dawn. It's not Maggie. It's Maggie Dawn, first and last name included. Tell us a little bit about why you first decided to run for an elected office. And tell us a little bit about your time in the state legislature.
Sure.
Because I think part of your career, what's interesting is you know, the move from the state legislature to the Common Council and now to a statewide office, and why, how different those different jobs are and how your career has taken that line over time, that evolution. So let's start at the beginning.
Yes.
Why run? I mean, the politics have been very difficult for very long. And why run for the state legislature?
So going way back when to the state legislature, it's funny. I love that there's a consistency to my story, to my narrative. And one of the reasons that I ultimately decided to run for office is because I was an active volunteer with the Democrats. And while I was getting more and more involved as a young adult in my volunteerism, I discovered that the district I lived in had the lowest voter turnout in the great state of Wisconsin.
Wow.
And I discovered that, gosh, even before Obama ran, I think I was volunteering for John Kerry the year that I, the election cycle that I discovered that I resided in the district with the lowest voter turnout in the state. And I, in that moment, knew that this was going to be my life's work, that I wanted to do everything I could to increase civic engagement in my community. And in particular, my district continues to be a supermajority Latino district. In particular, I wanted to increase civic engagement. I wanted to increase the vote in the Latino community. And even today, even though I have more reasons that I want to jump out there in a statewide, but I continue to have that goal to increase the political influence, the vote of the Latino community, the Latino population in the great state of Wisconsin.
Yeah, the engagement is, you know, unless you're showing up and voting, unless you are organizing and getting activated and part of the political process, it's very easy for elected officials, not just from your own district, but more broadly, to ignore you.
Yes.
And that happens to every community's detriment, right? Even if you don't happen to be a Latino person that lives in your district, if your district gets ignored, you know, these have like knock-on impacts, and they have these very long-term
results that you see, both either positive or negative, when certain constituencies have a lot of voice. And again, that voice expressed through organizing, but most importantly, by the showing up in the ballot box, right? You want to be influential, then you have to use the influence that you have, and that begets more influence, right?
Exactly.
You have to start with the baby steps in order to eventually have, again, more influence over your elected officials. So tell me a little bit about what it was like being in the state legislature, and can you contrast that with working for the city of Milwaukee's with the Common Council and your, the difference between those roles? I ask people who have served in both of these capacities this question because they're so different. And it's so fascinating to me. I've talked with former Alderman Bob Bauman, now a state representative. I've talked to a new state rep that used to be on the Beloit Village Board. And so those transitions are interesting to me because the way that you interact with constituents, what's possible, what's not, very different. What's your experience been like going from state legislature to a city legislature?
Yes, it is definitely. And I was elected in 2010. I served just about a decade in the state legislature and the state assembly, to be more specific, and then got elected in 2020 to serve in the city council, the common council here in Milwaukee. Honestly, I kind of wish I would have done it in the reverse, because I think I could have. It's just interesting to know so much more about local politics, what local electeds go through, and having to deal with what we do to them at the state level. But I miss the legislature sometimes. I certainly missed it when I left in 2020 and became alder at the height of the pandemic.
Right.
And wondered momentarily if I had made the wrong decision because it was just such a difficult time in the city, as you can imagine, across the country. Trying to do everything we could to get folks, you know, to figure out what we're going to do, one, and then finally getting the vaccine and then pushing to get people to get vaccinated and that whole hurdle. And, of course, the misinformation that was out there. It was such a daunting time, and I wondered if I made the wrong decision. But,
looking back now,
think? Oh, I've got my sea legs. I think that as a alder in the city of Milwaukee, I have much more influence and power than I did as a Democrat in the minority my entire tenure in the legislature. So in that regard, I don't regret it. But I certainly, I like the caucuses. I think I thrive in a team, and there's not that in the council. You know, it's nonpartisan.
Right.
You can't caucus, really, because it's much smaller numbers.
Yes.
So you can't have a walking quorum. And I miss the caucus. I really depended on the caucus. I thrived there for as much as it could be a little bit dysfunctional.
So for folks that don't know, let me explain. This is a really fascinating piece of government, like sort of detail operational stuff. And that is, on the state legislature, you can caucus with some of your party, probably not all of it, but like goodly amounts of your party, sometimes all of it, because you do not equal a quorum, which triggers open meetings requirements. A quorum is the technical term for the minimum amount of people required for a legislative body to do business. But when you turn and you look in local government, because the body is smaller, it takes fewer bodies to constitute the minimum number of people required to do business, meaning a minimum number for a quorum. And therefore, it is much easier to inadvertently trigger open meetings laws. This is generically referred to as a walking quorum. In other words, a bunch of legislators standing in a hall talking may in fact constitute a meeting that needs to be noticed and open to the public. So it's something that you have to be hyper aware of as a local elected official. And it just doesn't apply in the same way at the legislative level.
Correct. At the state legislature, the parties can caucus with their Republicans, the Assembly Republican caucus, they caucus, and that's completely allowable. And the Assembly Democrats, they caucus. On their own. These things are tradition in the legislature.
Yes.
And happen frequently. And you're exactly right. The same does not happen at the local level, at least not in Milwaukee.
Yeah, it shouldn't happen at the local level. It's one of those bits of it's a technical thing. But it can really sometimes make an elected official stumble because people, again, at the local level, those meetings are highly accessible. People know when they're happening. They are much more apt, especially if you're a Milwaukeean, to show up at a common council meeting than they might be to drive all the way to Madison to show up at a committee hearing. So there's this very intimate relationship. That's the best word I can use to describe it, between local elected officials and their constituents, because you're sort of the first line of help in many ways.
We're on the front lines, the elders. And that, I often say, is the beauty and the beast of it.
Sure.
Because I love being, and I love the fact that I do feel I'm on the front lines. I love being that much closer to my people. But at the same time, man, the constituency sometimes seems meaner than what I experienced when I was a state representative.
Mm.
And I don't know if that's the times we're living in right now, or if it's the office. And because you're an alder on the front lines, you're the first line of defense. You're the first one that constituent is going to give an earful to.
Yes. On things that are both within a city's powers to address and matters beyond. One of the things you began by saying, you have a much keener sense for how the state's decisions sort of trickle into and impact municipalities, especially when it comes to municipal budgets. It's one of those things that, having worked at various levels of government in my career, I have always wished that elected officials would have like an onboarding for legislators, especially, where it shows how all of these things link together and how federal grants work that are administered by states, and how sometimes those grant dollars then get passed down into city departments or municipal departments, and the interactions and where those jurisdictional overlaps are and where the tension points are, to help especially very newly elected officials get their arms around that, because it's one of the more complicated things. Let's turn a little bit to the Secretary of State's office and what it does in Wisconsin, and help people understand what does the Secretary of State do in a state like Wisconsin? Why is this an important office? Why should people care about the election? Because this was one of those offices that for many years, I don't think most people in the state were even, they might see it on the ballot, but it wasn't something that was top of mind for a lot of people. And that's changing a bit. Tell us about what does the Secretary of State do?
Well, the Secretary of State, and honestly, the truth is the Republicans have done a lot to gut the position. But if you ask our current Secretary of State, Sarah Godlewski, she'll tell you there's still a tremendous amount of responsibility in the office. I'm not yet elected, but our Madam Secretary of State Godlewski validates all vital records in the state. So about 15,000 cases per year come through her office. Also, the Secretary of State sits on the Board of Commissioner of Public Lands, and they manage about a $1.5 billion budget that really is doled out to libraries.
Mm.
And so it's a board that consists of the Secretary of State, the Treasurer, and the Attorney General. And so that's a very important responsibility. They meet every other week. And then last but not least, Madam Secretary of State made sure that I realized that I am in charge. I'm sorry, the Secretary of State, rather.
Yes.
I'm being overly confident. The Secretary of State is in charge of keeping record of the oaths of office. So for our legislators, when I became a state rep, I had to sign an oath of office. The Secretary of State manages and maintains all of those. And so they can be crucial when we have Republicans messing around and trying to decertify elections.
Yes. So we're going to talk more about that precise point and how these elections from about 10 years ago to today, the attention level has changed dramatically. We want to dispel a little bit of the mythology about what the Wisconsin Secretary of State's powers may be, or more importantly, are not anymore in this state. I'm joined by City of Milwaukee Alderwoman Jocasta Zamarripa, former state representative, newly announced candidate to be Wisconsin.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
Welcome back, everybody. My name is Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Really excited this afternoon to be joined for this half-hour block by current City of Milwaukee Alderwoman Jocasta Zamarripa. She has just announced her candidacy to become Secretary of State for the state of Wisconsin. And as I was saying into the lead-up to this interview, Secretary of State elections and offices used to be sleepy little affairs that most voters weren't paying a lot of attention to. But in the last decade, since Donald Trump started promulgating the big lie, spreading caboodles of misinformation about our voting systems and voters and how the votes get counted, two things have happened at once. The first one is we now are paying much more attention to elections like elections for secretaries of state. Now, from state to state, a secretary's duties will change drastically. And since the 60s, as I was talking with my guest Jocasta Zamarripa during the break, the Secretary of State's office in the state of Wisconsin has not been responsible for any portion of election administration. But watch this space. We'll get back to it. That's one thing that has happened. The second thing that has happened, which we're not going to get to today, but that deserves our thinking as we move forward, is understanding how we continue to ensure that our elections are safe and that every vote has counted. In other words, how do we continue to ensure the security of our elections moving forward? That's a topic for another day and is incredibly complicated, but to my dear guest, there is this essential task that the Secretary of State does, which was a really big deal in the 2020 election, and that is, as you and I were discussing, Jocasta, is that the Secretary of State is responsible for validating the, quote, certificate of votes for the presidential election. So it is the Secretary of State's office to which the, quote, slates of electors are submitted. So it is really important. Now, that job of the Secretary of State is supposed to be ministerial, meaning there's very little discretion. You receive the elector slate, you sign it, you affix the state seal, and off it goes to the Capitol. But it seems like that has been, a little under threat these days.
Yes.
So it's an incredibly important election for Wisconsinites to be aware of.
All the more reason for a Democrat to hold on to this seat now more than ever, as we've seen, unfortunately, some of the games that Trump and his Republican cronies have tried to play with elections. We just need to make sure that we hang on to the Secretary of State office and make sure that elections are fair and we don't have anybody trying to run amok with them.
Yeah, the idea of a fake or an alternate slate of electors is just anathema to our democratic processes under the sorts of circumstances where they were put forward in the 2020 cycle. Alderwoman, I wanted to give you an opportunity to address some of the equity work that you've done to ensure that every single person in our community has the opportunity to succeed and to really live the American dream themselves. Tell us a little bit about your advocacy.
Thank you, Maggie Dawn. I've already mentioned it. I was the first Latina woman elected to the state legislature when I became a state rep in 2010. When I ran for the Common Council, I was the first Latina woman to win a seat on the Milwaukee Common Council and serve as alderperson. These historic victories are not just mine. They're this community's, and they're Milwaukee's, and they're Wisconsin's victories. We need to make sure that we have a diverse slate of voices at the table. Tammy Baldwin says it so well: if we're not at the table, we're on the menu. And so, to be an out member of our LGBTQ+ community and running for a statewide office, to be a Latina hailing from this Latino community, where many immigrants are a part of these communities as well, and are under attack by the Trump administration, it just is more important to me than ever to take on this challenge of a statewide office. And as much of an OG as I am, running for a state assembly district or an aldermanic district, this statewide office is a different animal. Yeah. But I'm ready for it, and I'm excited to get out there and meet as many Wisconsinites as possible. And I hope they'll have me.
Yes, I have often bemoaned the fact that for the city of Milwaukee and Milwaukee County, we've never had a chief executive elected official that is a woman. Yes. And there continue to be these sorts of ceilings. And I just like to say this, No one deserves or is entitled to a position because of their race or their gender or their sexual identity. It is equally true that no one should be eliminated from those jobs because of those same factors. And everyone, if you have the skills and the work ethic, should have the right to raise their hand and acknowledge that there has never been a female Latina that has held a statewide office in this state, and that we have an incredibly diverse community of Wisconsinites that include Latinos and Latinas, and that folks deserve to see themselves in their elected offices. So I wish you the best in your campaign. I hope you come back and can give us some updates.
Absolutely.
As it gets underway, I think this is going to be an incredibly exciting, and I hope, to your original point, incredibly engaging election cycle with a robust slate of Democrats putting their hat in for the gubernatorial primary. We've got Sarah that's running for lieutenant governor, of course.
Yes.
So much action in the space. As you address Wisconsin voters writ large, Jocasta, tell Wisconsin voters what your message is. How do we bring people from a variety of different political viewpoints together to help and protect democracy and move this state forward together?
I hope that when I get out there and start traveling the state and meeting folks from every corner of Wisconsin, that they'll see how much we have in common.
Yes.
Whether you're from the largest city in the state like I am, or you're from Sparta, Wisconsin, I just think they'll hear the Wisconsin accent in my voice and realize, hey, she's one of us, she's one
yes.
of me, and we can work together to do the best that we can for this great state.
Well, best of luck to you, current city alderwoman Jocasta Zamarripa, friend of mine and now a friend of yours.
Yes.
Congratulations on your announcement. Folks, don't go anywhere. When we come back, we talk a little Packers, little Brewers, and other news.
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.